is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. President Erdogan wants the envoys of the ten Western states, including the U.S., to leave Turkey just days after they called for the release of a jailed critic. Britain and the European Union embroiled in a dispute over a post-Brexit trade deal. London is warning substantial gaps still remain. Also ahead, rallies against social conditions and COVID rules hitting France as the country gears up for next year's presidential race. We'll have a report from Paris. Welcome to the program. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has ordered the expulsion of the ambassadors of 10 countries who've called for the release of a jailed opposition leader.
You cannot dare to come to the Turkish Foreign Ministry and give orders. Here, I give the necessary order to our foreign minister and said what must be done. These 10 ambassadors must be declared persona non grata at once. You will sort it out immediately.
Erdogan accused the envoys of indecency and declared the 10 ambassadors as persona non grata, a diplomatic term used to signify the step before expulsion. In a joint statement last week, the ambassadors of the U.S., Canada, Denmark, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and New Zealand called for a just and speedy resolution to Osman Kavala's case. They were later summoned by the Turkish Foreign Ministry, which called the statement irresponsible. Kavala has been in prison since late 2017, charged with financing nationwide protests in 2013 and involvement in a 2016 failed coup. Tensions mounting between Moscow and NATO. Russia has accused the Western military alliance of amassing troops near its borders. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu has accused NATO of unwillingness to discuss European security on equal grounds. He noted that security must be mutual and not infringe on Moscow's interests. Shoigu blames NATO for causing a catastrophe in Afghanistan. Russian defense chief's remarks came amid heightened tensions with NATO. On Thursday, the member states of the Brussels-based body agreed on a new strategy aimed at deterring Russia. The Kremlin had already severed ties with NATO in retaliation for the bloc's expulsion of 8 Russian diplomats. Now Britain is warning that time may be running out to resolve post-Brexit trade disputes with the European Union. The UK government says the ongoing talks with the EU have been constructive, but that the two sides are still far apart on fundamental issues. London says it wants real progress soon on trade rules for Northern Ireland, which is the central problem. The two sides have met in Brussels over the past week to bridge their gaps, but so far, no success. Now, they're planning to move the talks to London. Northern Ireland is part of the UK, but it remains inside the EU's single market for goods, even after Britain's departure from the bloc at the end of 2020. The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll on Europe, with several countries reporting a surge in infections and related deaths. Germany has recorded its highest COVID infection rate since May, with 100 cases per 100,000 people in the past 7 days. Over 15,000 new cases and 86 new deaths were recorded in the past day. In Britain, officials registered the largest number of infections since July over the past week. On Saturday alone, around 45,000 new cases and 135 new deaths were reported. Meanwhile, Romania plans to reintroduce a nighttime curfew and make health passes mandatory for entry to most public venues. This follows record numbers of daily COVID-19 deaths and infections this month, which have stretched the hospital system to breaking point. Now, in the coming days, residents of Melbourne, the capital of Australia's Victoria State, will see more COVID restrictions eased, with the full vaccination rate there hitting 80%.
I can confirm that at 6 p.m. this Friday, we will flick the switch and we will move to 80%. Whether we have ticked over the 80% settings, we will definitely do that over the course of the weekend. So one set of rules that covers the entire state. Freedom of movement across the entire state.
The Victorian Premier also says Melbournians will be able to travel and book holidays. What's more, masks will not be required outdoors. Melbourne was the world's most locked down city that emerged from its latest spate of restrictions just 2 days ago. Home to about 5 million people, the city went through nearly 9 months of stay-at-home restrictions during 6 lockdowns from March of 2020. Vaccine rollout is now moving at full speed across the nation. Massive social unrest across multiple sectors has hit France for the first time in over a year and a half. Workers, yellow vests, and those upset at another extension of a state of emergency took to the streets nationwide. And with the presidential election getting closer, Ramin Mazohedi is in Paris.
Mass social unrest has returned to France as across the country there were rail strikes against poor conditions and pay, yellow vest demonstrations, fuel price demonstrations, and protests against another state of emergency to prolong the era of coronavirus restrictions. France is now exactly 6 months from their final presidential vote, and many believe it is about to enter another period of extended social turmoil.
Things really could explode because prices keep going up, but wages don't. If Macron somehow wins re-election, then social unrest will go sky high. The yellow vests will really take to the streets then, and it will be much worse than in 2019.
Last week, the yellow vests began what they dubbed Season 2. And while they began as a protest against record fuel prices, records which have just been topped, the movement spread to dozens of nations worldwide and encompassed a host of progressive demands. The government just declared they'll grant 100 euros to help about half the country defray energy bills, but few protesters were impressed by the announcement.
We are not beggars. What is 100 euros only given one time? State taxes compose 60% of the prices of gasoline. So calling it 100 euros is totally false. The people truly only receive 40 euros. This is election nonsense, but Macron won't win votes with these crumbs.
For almost 4 consecutive months, at least tens and often hundreds of thousands of people have marched nationwide against what many say are now de facto coronavirus vaccine mandates. France is one of the most vaccine skeptical countries in the world, and that was according to polls taken before the emergence of Corona 19. These protests are also against lockdown measures, which they say are no longer necessary, have gutted the savings of workers, destroyed small businesses, increased the wealth of the rich and corporations, and allowed France's executive branch to continue grabbing even more power away from the legislative, judicial, and local branches of government. Combined with the explosive social conditions is a looming presidential election in which all three of the leading candidates are on the far right, either economically or socially, or both. That in turn has caused anger, abstention, and apathy to be nearly as popular. Ramin Mazahiri, Press TV, Paris.
Move on now. In 6 months, Hungary will be holding what's expected to be its toughest election in 15 years. With tensions building up already, supporters of the ruling party and the opposition have held rival rallies in the capital, Budapest. Tens of thousands of people gathered to hear what Prime Minister Viktor Orban had to say on a national day marking Hungary's failed uprising against the Soviet Union almost 7 decades ago. There, Orban compared the European Union's treatment of Hungary to the Soviets' hostility. There's been a dispute between the two sides over the primacy of EU law. Also, thousands of supporters of opposition leader Peter Márkizay held their own gathering. He told the crowd that people have had enough of Orban's hate campaigns, including his anti-immigration policies. Márkizay is leading a coalition of 6 leftist parties. They're hoping to end Orban's 10-year rule. Opinion polls show that they are neck and neck. More than 44,000 Yemenis, including thousands of children, were killed or injured during the years-long war imposed on the Arab country by Saudi Arabia. That's according to a recent report by a Yemeni rights group. Our correspondent in Sana'a reports.
A Yemeni human rights group called the Eye for Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a report on casualties caused by 6 years of Saudi-led war on Yemen. The report says more than 44,000 civilians have been killed or injured since 2015, when Riyadh launched an aggression against Sana'a. Thousands of women and the children are among the victims, according to the report.
We released a report on the casualties of the Yemen war during the past 2,400 days of the conflict. 44,221 civilians were killed or injured, targeted by airstrikes and cluster bombs. More than 4,000 children and 2,800 women are among the victims who lost their lives.
Also, hundreds have been left with permanent disabilities, the report says. Thousands of civilian facilities were also targeted by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes. Hospitals, schools, and power stations were bombed across Yemen, affecting lives of millions of Yemenis in a country already hit hard by poverty.
The Saudi-led coalition has deliberately targeted civilian facilities to kill civilians. It did not differentiate between civilian and military targets. The coalition has violated international laws that ban military attacks on civilian facilities.
However, infrastructure are not the only civilian targets hit by Saudi and coalition warplanes. According to the report, more than 500,000 homes have been destroyed during the war. As a result, millions of Yemenis have been displaced across the country.
The ongoing Saudi war and the blockade imposed on Yemen is killing more Yemenis, as it has deprived millions of civilians, including children, of their basic needs, such as food and medicine. However, the international community remains silent, regardless of the situation in Yemen, which the United Nations describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Taliban have condemned the United States for the crimes it committed against the Afghan people over 20 years of war. Taliban has also called for an international investigation, urging Washington to compensate for its acts of brutality. Here's a report from Kabul.
Nearly 2 decades have passed since the invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S. Washington has withdrawn its forces from Afghanistan, and Taliban has retaken the control over the country. While the scene seems settled, an issue remains outstanding: the crimes the U.S. committed in the country. The Taliban now criticize the U.S. and its allies for the casualties and damages in Afghanistan, calling for an international probe into the crimes committed by their forces during the invasion.
America has been killing innocent Afghan people for the last 20 years and causing damages across Afghanistan. An international commission must be established to investigate the cases and make the U.S. compensate for its atrocities against the Afghan people.
Afghan people too blame the U.S. for the situation in Afghanistan. They call on international community to hold the U.S. accountable for its crimes during the war, as well as the destruction that have affected their lives.
The U.S. killing of Afghan civilians in airstrikes was a continuous process during the last 20 years. Their forces used to blindly target people's assets and houses. We demand justice from international bodies.
I witnessed when U.S. forces shot Afghan civilians at Kabul airport during withdrawal days. What was the fault of poor people that were killed? They should pay for what they have done in this country.
The Taliban has also called for a UN donor conference to help Afghanistan tackle its crisis. The call was welcomed at Moscow format, where representatives from 10 countries supported convening such a conference. However, the U.S. and the coalition that invaded Afghanistan have to play a major role in reconstructing Afghanistan, the Moscow format participant countries said.
2 decades of U.S. presence in Afghanistan have left the country in economic and humanitarian crisis. Afghans said the U.S. has to shoulder the responsibility of its disastrous presence in the country and has to be held accountable for the crimes, including thousands of unprobed deaths. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The 35th International Islamic Unity Conference has wrapped up its work in the Iranian capital. The event provided an opportunity for Muslim scholars and thinkers to discuss the main challenges of the Islamic Ummah. Here's a report from Tehran.
The 35th edition of the International Islamic Unity Conference came to an end on Saturday. During the six-day event, almost 500 Muslim scholars, elites, and religious leaders delivered speeches and exchanged views on the latest developments in the world of Islam. The 35th annual meeting, titled Islamic Unity, Peace, and Avoidance of Division and Conflict in the World of Islam, was held mainly virtually, while a limited number of participants delivered speeches at the opening and closing ceremony in person. Addressing the closing ceremony, Iran's parliament speaker, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, said proximity among different Islamic schools of thought forms a united front among Muslims against extremism and Takfiri currents.
Proximity among different Islamic schools of thoughts forms a united front among Muslims against extremism and Takfiri currents. Today, the enemies of Islam are trying to sow the seeds of discord among Muslims, but we should be vigilant. Palestine is still one of the main commonalities among Muslim nations. The issue of Palestine has always been the main concern of the Islamic world, which can forge further solidarity among Muslims.
The topics of discussions during this conference included Islamic Brotherhood encountering terrorism, religious free thinking, confronting Takfiri currents and extremism, and also Islamic empathy and sympathy, as well as the avoidance of tensions and conflicts.
The Palestinian issue is the highly sensitive issue of the Islamic Ummah. Unfortunately, at present, certain countries are hatching plots against the Palestinians and seek to annihilate the resistance. But Palestine will remain as the main issue of the Islamic world and will never lose its importance to Muslims.
Regarding the Islamic unity, first of all, we thank the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, who initiated the Islamic Unity Week. During this week, more than any other time, Muslims around the world think about the importance of unity and solidarity among Muslim nations. I think Palestine is still the main concern of the Islamic Ummah. And if all Muslim nations get united regarding Palestine, most of the problems of the Islamic world will be solved.
The International Islamic Unity Conference is an international conference which is held every year during the Islamic Unity Week in Iran and is organized by the World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought.
The event provided an opportunity for different Islamic schools of thought to discuss the main challenges facing the Islamic world today and further boost solidarity among Muslim nations worldwide. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Points to ponder on the Prophet's birthday. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and heartiest congratulations to you all on one of the most blessed days of the year. Today is a grand day in the history of mankind, when the Almighty Creator of the universe decided to bring into the world His last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. It is actually a day of double blessing, for it is the day on whose 136th anniversary was born the Prophet's sixth infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him. So, first listen to a special program on the Prophet of Peace, and here we present you Ayah 28 of Surah Fath, where God Almighty informs mankind, "It is He who has sent His Prophet with guidance and the true religion, that He may make it prevail over all religions, and Allah suffices as witness. Today, the 17th of Rabiul Awwal, is that grand day in the history of planet Earth when God decreed the physical birth of the first ever creation, a being of celestial light, more ancient than not just the galaxies and the planetary systems containing resplendent stars and suns, but also more superior to the angels and cherubim, including Gabriel, who were all created well after him. Those in doubt are advised to read the Noble Quran more thoroughly and with an insight supported by the light of faith, in order to understand the divine words about the last and greatest messenger who was entrusted with the universal mission of Islam for all mankind and for all time, as Ayah 107 of Surah Anbiya bears witness, "We have not sent you but as mercy unto the creation." Such words were not used by the All-Wise Creator regarding the mission of any other prophet, since their missions time-bound and geographically confined. That was the reason the prophets of the past had prophesied the coming of the Master of all divine messengers, predictions whose traces remain in the sacred text of all religions, despite the tampering of interpolators over the millenniums. The Noble Quran has preserved examples of such prophecies, like the prayer of Prophet Abraham, peace upon him, and the tidings of the virgin-born Messiah to his followers, as testified by Ayah 6 of the Surah. O children of Israel, indeed I am the Prophet of Allah to you, to confirm what is before me of the Torah, and to give the tidings of the prophets to come after me, whose name is Ahmad. Now we understand the divine promise to make the truth of Islam prevail over all religions, creeds that divided humanity into sects and cults by changing the contents of the heavenly scriptures and coining a weird belief, such as Paul, the Hellenized Jews' transformation of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, into God's Son. It was for this reason that the seal of messengers was born in the full limelight of history in Mecca, in the morally virtuous family of the monotheist Bani Hashim clan, descended from Prophet Abraham's firstborn son, Prophet Ishmael, peace upon him. Thus, the anniversary of this blessed day is an occasion to celebrate as a God-pleasing duty for every true Muslim, since divine providence decreed that this was no ordinary birth. As a matter of fact, as history bears testimony, Prophet Muhammad's birth was preceded by and accompanied with miracles, such as the divine wrath that struck the elephantine hordes of Abrahe, the Abyssinian governor of Yemen, who intended to destroy the Holy Kaaba. It would be repetitive to say the idols installed in Abraham's monotheist edifice, the Holy Kaaba, by the pagan Arabs, crashed headlong on the night of his birth. In Ctesiphon, in Madoen in Iraq, a crack appeared in the main arch of the palace of the Sassanid king of kings, Anushirvan, while 14 parapets fell to the ground from atop the royal residence. In interior Iran, the sacred fire kept burning for centuries, and the main Zoroastrian temple suddenly died down. Similar miracles were witnessed in far-off China, as well as in India and in the Roman Empire, spread across Europe and North Africa, heralding the birth of the deliverer of mankind. Perhaps the skeptics, including the so-called Muslims who frown upon the birthday celebrations of the greatest prophet, may say Islam has failed to prevail over all religions, and moreover, their differences about the date of his birth anniversary as well as jurisprudential matters. In addition, Islam today in non-Muslim countries is depicted as the creed of cutthroats, of mass murderers, of cannibalistic terrorists, of jihadi rapists, and the like. This deliberate distortion of facts warrants us to scientifically probe the exemplary life of the best of creation, the dynamic legacy he left, and for whom, and did those who claim to be the political representatives of the Prophet of Peace follow his advice and formula for unity, especially the following hadith: I am leaving behind among you the thaqalain, or two weighty things, the Book of God, Quran, and my progeny, the Ahlul Bayt. Hold fast to them, and you will not go astray, for the two never separate with each other, even when they return to me at the fountain of Kothar on Resurrection Day. The answer is obvious. The caliphate was hijacked, and any usurper, whether of the past when military power subdued lands from Spain in the west to the borders of India and China in the east, or of our times when terrorists masquerade as Muslims, cannot make any deviant ideology prevail over all other religions. This means God's promise of Islam's peaceful prevailing over all creeds will only be fulfilled when the master of the affairs are the legitimate and divinely designated successors of the Messenger of Mercy. For this reason, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, had said without mincing words, as recorded in the hadith compilations of our Sunni brethren as well, the world will not end until my descendant, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, will reappear to establish the global government of peace and justice by ending corruption and oppression. As for the actual date of his birth, this is not a matter of contention, as was wisely resolved by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, in 1979, when he designated the Islamic Unity Week to bridge the 12th and 17th span. The Prophet's 16th fallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, has said that on the birth of his illustrious ancestor Fatemeh bint Asad, peace upon her, the mother of Imam Ali, peace upon him, rushed to her husband Abu Talib and gave the good news of the birth of a radiant nephew to him. She also described strange things about the wonderful birth. Abu Talib said, "After 30 years, a son will be born to you too, who will be like this newborn in every aspect except prophethood." Abu Talib, peace upon him, performed the aqiqah, or hair-removing ceremony of his nephew on the seventh day of birth and invited the entire Hashemite clan to the feast, saying it is the walimeh, or banquet of Ahmad. Asked why was Muhammad being called Ahmad, he said, "Those in the heaven praise him as such." The pseudo-Muslims, wrongly accusing the Prophet's guardian and uncle, who till the last years of his life fiercely protected his nephew from the plots of the pagan Arabs, of lacking faith in Islam, should read the Noble Quran, where in Ayah 6 of Surah Saf, the Almighty Allah has quoted the tidings of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, to his followers some 6 centuries before the birth of the Prophet of Islam, foretelling the coming of the Prophet after him named Ahmad. It is interesting to note that the Gospel of Saint John, despite the tampering it has gone through, still preserves the words of Jesus of the coming of the last and greatest prophet as Comforter in English translation and Paraclete in its Greek translation, which is the translation of the original Hebrew Aramaic word Hamdah, or the praiseworthy, and which in Arabic means Ahmad. This is further proof of the universal mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, to all mankind, the reliability of the narrations of his monotheist household, and the logic behind celebrations of his blessed birth. It is outside the scope of this brief radio program to mention the prophecies of Prophet Moses and Prophet Isaiah about the last prophet, or the predictions in the sacred texts of the Zoroastrians and the Hindus of Islam's worldwide triumph. Goodbye and God bless you all.
Congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 17th of Rabi al-Awwal, the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is in fact a day of double celebration. We also celebrate the birth anniversary of the sixth infallible successor of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Congratulations to all of our listeners throughout the world on this very auspicious occasion.
Communique. 7 people were shot dead and dozens more wounded in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, after snipers belonging to the Lebanese Forces militia opened fire at a peaceful protest led by Hezbollah and Amal protesters. In the mainstream media, they've called them clashes. Many Lebanese accuse them of purposely hiding or obfuscating the identities of the victims and even of blaming Hezbollah for the violence. So were these just clashes, as some in the media have suggested, or something more sinister aimed at provoking a reaction from Hezbollah, an escalation, and dragging Lebanon into a civil war? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. October 14th, seven people were martyred and dozens more wounded after snipers opened fire at protesters in Beirut's Tayuna district. The majority of the victims, supporters of Hezbollah and its ally, the Amal movement, who gathered outside the Palace of Justice. Intended as a peaceful, unarmed protest, Hezbollah called for the demonstration the day before to protest against a judge named Tariq Bitar, who people accuse of politicizing the investigation into the Beirut port explosion. Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar reported that the American ambassador to Lebanon, Dorothy Shia, was attempting to frame Hezbollah for the explosion and influence the investigation. As protesters gathered outside the Palace of Justice, sniper fire began to erupt as gunmen on the surrounding buildings began firing at the protesters from rooftops and other vantage points. After the violence erupted, the armed wings of these groups then arrived with weapons to defend the protesters. And I think this is a very important point to understand, because some people in the Western mainstream media and Lebanese media have referred to the massacre as a clash, implying an exchange of fire between two sides. But is that really how things went down? Because when snipers start shooting at protesters, that's an ambush. It's an attack. It's not a clash, which would require both sides to be fighting from the start. Now, some people have also posted videos online saying, look, you see, the protesters were armed. Hezbollah and Amal, they brought weapons to the protest. They asked for it. But this is, again, untrue. One of the martyrs was a mother waiting at the window for her children to come home from school. She wasn't even at the protest, let alone carrying a weapon. How do you explain her death? The demonstration that took place was live streamed. There are tons of videos and photographs showing very clearly that no one was armed. You can see here, as the shooting begins, there isn't a single weapon in the entire shot. The videos of people carrying weapons are from afterwards, after the snipers had already shot and killed protesters. It's only then that people came from nearby districts in order to defend the protesters. So that's a completely different story and a very important distinction to make. All the victims had head wounds, indicating a clear intent to kill. Not to deter, nor disperse, nor defend, or whatever other excuse the apologists for this massacre have concocted. The Lebanese army even put out a tweet confirming that protesters had been shot at. They didn't say that armed groups or personnel were shot at. They said protesters. The Minister of Interior also confirmed that this was indeed a massacre, an ambush, and not some clash. Of course, some people in the media, they don't even want to disclose the identity of the victims. Hezbollah is always the bad guy, according to them. So when Hezbollah supporters are being massacred in broad daylight, this runs counter to their usual narrative. And if you look at the various headlines in the press, you can see how they use this passive language to avoid telling the truth. If you read their headlines, you would never know what actually happened and who was shot at. So they're basically lying about what happened, either calling it a clash or trying to obfuscate the identity of the victims. And we know that the victims are mostly Hezbollah and Amal supporters. So what about the perpetrators? Who was behind the attack? Well, the Lebanese army has so far arrested a total of 19 people in connection with the attack. It is widely assumed that a right-wing Christian militia and a rival of Hezbollah, known as the Lebanese Forces, they were behind the massacre. And if you knew anything about the history of the Lebanese Forces and the history of their leader, Samir Jaja, this would hardly surprise you. As a matter of fact, this recent attack pales in comparison with their other atrocities when they killed scores of Christians, Muslims, Palestinians, Armenians. Not only that, but during the Lebanese Civil War, the Lebanese Forces militia committed treason and collaborated with Israel, an invading and occupying force, to carry out these attacks. They received funding, clothing, and weapons from the Israelis. And in September 1982, together, they committed one of the most horrific massacres, murdering 3,500 Palestinians and Lebanese Shia in Beirut. The leader of the Lebanese Forces militia, Samir Jaja, was also found guilty of assassinating the Lebanese Prime Minister, Rashid Karami, in 1987, and Danish Namoun in 1990. Today, Zsa Zsa also enjoys funding and support from Saudi Arabia and the United States, who have a vested interest in fracturing Lebanon and weakening Hezbollah.
One of the victims, Mohammed Tamer, is reported to have been killed not by the Lebanese forces militia, but actually by the Lebanese army. The authenticity of CCTV footage posted online appeared to be confirmed when the Lebanese army said that the soldier in question is now under investigation.
The scenes of this latest massacre in Beirut are a painful reminder to many of Lebanon's civil war, which lasted 15 years and took place on these very streets. It is with that in mind that Hezbollah and Amal released an official statement following the shooting, asking people to remain calm and refrain from retaliating to the murders, for fear of escalating the situation and dragging Lebanon into another civil war, which is perhaps what Zsa Zsa and his backers would very much like to do. To discuss more, I'm joined by Zainab El-Safar. She's an Iraqi-Lebanese journalist and the host of the television program Min Al-Dakhil, which airs weekly on El Mayadin. First of all, let me say thank you, Zainab, for coming on the program. It's great to finally have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Richard. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
So, Zainab, can you perhaps just walk us through what happened yesterday in Beirut? First of all, why were people outside? What were they protesting against? Who was protesting? And what is really the issue at hand?
At the night before, the eve before, there were certain kind of suspicious movements in the neighborhoods facing the place that the events took place yesterday. And this is something very suspicious because, you know, when such kind of movements, mobilizations take place by people in black, and they are trying to secure certain kind of neighborhoods, avenues, and streets, and they were trying to deploy their militias over there, and the security forces and the various security forces, they didn't move an eye to all this kind of movement. We have to ask questions and we have to pose questions as, where is the preemptive security that ought to be there at certain points in time? So the next day, the people who were on the streets, let me just tell you and walk you through the events that took place. It is in repercussion to the politicizing of the judge that is in charge of the probe of the Beirut blast that occurred last year on the 4th of August. This particular judge, this unfortunately, we tend to call them justice, but there is no justice in what they are doing. His measures are so discretionary and politicized to the sense that he wanted to deviate the probe from its ultimate aims. And he issued certain kind of subpoenas and orders that were really so suspicious. They were highly politicized. There is no kind of justice or order in whatever he was doing. So the people took to the streets, civilians, unarmed, peaceful demonstrators, people who belong to the elite of Lebanon, lawyers, engineers, teachers. They took to the streets and they were unarmed. Okay, so what happened is that the moment they took to the streets at 10:45 a.m. exactly, fire, sniper fire, heavy, a salvo of sniper fire were started to shoot in their direction. We had seven martyrs, among them a woman, Maryam Farhat. She's the mother of five. I cannot just put them into words and say what has happened. It's like a kind of dragging the people. The events, you know, if you just want to paint the picture, they were so much reminiscent of what took place, what instigated the Lebanese civil war back in 1975. The place and the way the events were taking place and escalating. 4 hours of intense gunfire, incessant gunfire. What does that mean? And nothing happened to stop them.
When you mention this poor woman who was killed in her home and, you know, the protesters were unarmed, I mean, this is a very important point because you have a lot of people posting videos, people online saying that the protesters were armed, that they came to the protest with weapons. Is that true? Or were those videos from afterwards, after the snipers had already shot and killed some of the protesters in front of the Palace of Justice?
Unfortunately, Richard, a lot of media outlets, local media outlets and foreign media outlets, are accomplices in the crime that took place against the people, the innocent people of demonstration. The way they were trying to promote that this matter has boiled down into clashes. Clashes take place between two sides. But this is, you know, the Lebanese forces, militias, those lunatic mercenaries performing, perpetrating this massacre, this intended, pre-planned, pre-orchestrated, and perpetrated massacre against civilians. They were trying to show that the matter is only a kind of clashes, you know, an action and a reaction. No way. Nobody. We said and we underscored the fact that those protesters were unarmed and were peaceful, and they were from the elite, as I said. Those people, they shot at a demonstration, demonstrators, they shot back and there was an exchange of fire. This was not the case at all. Only the army, you know, deployed, and they deployed their armored personnel, and they were trying to take hold of the situation, 4 hours of intense fire, until they tried to apprehend those perpetrators, and 8 of them are apprehended, and they said that, well, they admitted what they were doing.
What did you make of not just local commentators, but international media portraying it as, you know, a fight between two sides and omitting the victims, that they're Hezbollah and Amal supporters, from the headlines, the subheadings, you know, it just wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. It was a kind of, you know, it's part also of the whole choir of trying to show that, well, you know, it's the beginning, the flames of a civil war that is has just erupted and is going to burn Lebanon. It's between a Christian side, you know, and even in the geography, Na'in al-Rumani, you say Christian side, populated by the Christians, and then you say Ash-Shia'a and Tayyuni is populated by the Shia mostly, and you say that, well, it's a kind of civil war between the Christians and the Shia, Amal and Hezbollah. They represent the greatest number of Shia in Lebanon, but this was not that, and this is what they want to sell, because, you know, as we all know, that Hezbollah has a very deep-rooted alliance with the Free Patriotic Movement, which is one of the biggest Christian parties in Lebanon, and also Amal Movement has also alliance with the Merida. Hezbollah has also with the Merida. They are all Christians, and they are also people who suffered from the massacres perpetrated by the Lebanese forces against their own people, the Christians, their fellow Christians themselves. The Lebanese forces, party and militia, what they were doing is what they have always been doing, what they are used to be doing. They are mercenaries in the hands of those who pay the higher bid. You know, they are funded by certain Arab regimes, and they take the orders from the Americans, and they perpetrate massacres. We don't, it does not escape us ever, you know, what happened in Sabra and Shatila, and who was responsible for what happened in Sabra and Shatila, where 3,500 people, innocent Palestinians and Lebanese, at least 80 people from Al-Muqdad family, they have been assassinated in a mode which is, they have been butchered. Women, children, elderly, they have been butchered in the Sabra neighborhood just adjacent to the Shatila refugee camp.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the Lebanese army, they arrested members of this Christian militia, the Lebanese forces, for this attack. But it's not really out of place for them, is it? I mean, they have a whole history of this barbarism, let's call it what it is, this barbarism against all various walks of life in Lebanon, as you mentioned. And I think it's really important for people to understand what they are. You know, it's really astonishing for me that someone like Zsa Zsa is a free man. It's really unconscionable, isn't it?
Yes, he was given amnesty back in 2005, and then you know how events escalated back in 2005 with the assassination of the slain Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, and then how Lebanon went into this kind of, you know, those events that the aim and target of which was to target the resistance in Lebanon. Then you had 2006, which is the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. But, you know, whoever stood in the face of the resistance has always been defeated. and Hezbollah in Lebanon is part and parcel of the fabric. It is a community. It has a large swathe of constituency. And we have to understand something, speaking of constituency, is that we are very soon approaching the elections in Lebanon, the parliamentary elections. And whatever we see, any kind of instability, any kind of event, is going to be in order to try and tip the balance of elections, because the Lebanese forces, they know for sure that, you know, former member of parliament Walid Jumblatt is no longer allying with them in Baabda and Ashouf, and he said so clearly. And also Al-Hariri, which is the future bloc, is not aligned with them in the Akkar region, in the Hirmil, and somewhere else. So they are, according to this new electoral law, they will be losing a lot of seats in the forthcoming elections. And whatever they have done, Richard, they opened their own fire at themselves. This is not something that is going to pass easily. The blood of the martyrs is not going to stay on the streets. There's going to be a kind of accountability, a solid accountability, a vendetta also, not only from those particular people, the way, you know, those people who were also responsible for the events that took place in Khaldi and the killing, the cold blood killing of the people in Khaldi, and those who were also the next day in the funeral procession. Their masters, who are the servants of another master, which is a master that was and is always defeated today, defeated in Afghanistan, defeated in Iraq, defeated in Syria, defeated elsewhere, is also going to be defeated in Lebanon, Richard, sooner rather than later.
Zainab, when you speak of their masters, this is a very important point. What role do the United States, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Israel, what role do they play in this attack and in Lebanese politics in general? Is it true, for example, that the Lebanese forces militia was training in Saudi Arabia? You know, what else is the American embassy, what role does the American ambassador play in all this? And what goal are they trying to achieve here? You mentioned destabilizing the elections as one example. Is this also part of a plan to weaken the axis of resistance, to disarm Hezbollah? What about Lebanon's gas and natural resources?
Of course, everything that the Americans have been doing in the region and also in Lebanon in particular, the sanctions against Lebanon, the sanctions against lots of personalities who are allied with the resistance in Lebanon, it's a mode of trying to weaken the resistance in Lebanon and trying to turn the people of Lebanon, the people of the resistance, against their own resistance. And, you know, the American ambassador has been doing all this witchcraft, if I might say, all these kind of suspicious and all these kind of, you know, the imperial moves trying to control Lebanon and the Lebanese institutions, but she's failing. And, you know, the moment Hezbollah tried to get the ship of fuel from Iran, the next day she said that, well, we're going to get gas from Egypt through Syria. Syria that was sanctioned by the very Americans through the Caesar law. They broke the Caesar law, and, you know, and she was reprimanded by her administration, saying that, well, you don't need this Sayyid Nasrallah to do something, and then you have to retaliate the next day to show that you are strong and flexing your muscles. But anyways, she is doing her best. She is on the line of the Pompeo recommendations, still trying to, in her dreams, she dreams a lot, that she dreams of disbanding and disarming Hezbollah and, you know, dismantling this kind of party and the people of it, and turning the people of the resistance and the quote-unquote Shia against Hezbollah. Well, this is just in your dreams. These are chimeras, and this is something that can never be true. Regarding the fact that we heard yesterday a very important statement by the mother of the martyr, Maryam Farhat, in yesterday events, in the massacre that took place yesterday, she said, well, they are not going to move us one iota against the resistance. We know those scenarios. We know the play, this theatrical thing that is taking place against us. We know the ultimate aims of, and we're not going to move. That's why the people of Lebanon yesterday, and I say the people of Lebanon, the true, honest people of Lebanon, they were not being dragged to a kind of civil war, to a kind of sedition, to a kind of discord, because whatever took place, it's not so much strange to us. We know these scenarios, and nobody can drag us again to a civil war.
Zainab Al-Safar, thank you so much for your time. It's really a pleasure having your insightful knowledge and graceful presentation on the program. Really great speaking with you.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Richard. Thank you very much.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
In order to understand the Tayuni massacre that just took place in Beirut, we have to understand the general context of Lebanon's political situation. As we've covered before on the program, Lebanon is under a de facto U.S. siege, its economy in turmoil, and as such, Lebanon remains a very fragile nation in need of political reform. As of recently, Hezbollah has